Welcome to the ADA podcast about when CBT doesn't work at first. Today we're talking with Dr. Michelle Krask at the University of California at Los Angeles. Dr. Krask, let me ask you the first question. Conquering an anxiety disorder can take a lot of time and effort, and why is that?
Well, when you think about it, anxiety disorders as we currently understand them develop from a set of vulnerabilities and a set of very potent learning experiences which lead the person to become afraid or anxious about certain situations. And so the goal of therapy is to structure new learning experiences that themselves become so potent that they overpower or become more relevant than the early learning experiences. And so that can take some time, that can take some effort.
And what exactly is CBT and why has it been effective?
Cognitive behavioral therapy is a set of procedures, both cognitive and behavioral, of course, that developed out of learning theory, learning science about how emotions are acquired, and memory research about how emotions are recalled, and also a lot of very good clinical observation that highlighted the importance of the way in which patients or clients think. And putting all those things together produced a set of strategies which are designed to teach individuals ways of coping and managing their emotions by changing their behavior and by changing the way they think and by changing their emotional response. It's effective, I think, for a number of reasons. One is because it has been derived from empirical science. And so a lot of experimental work is the basis of cognitive behavioral therapy. And moreover, being empirical in nature means that the therapy itself is continuously updated by the latest advances in the science. So some of the latest work on exposure therapy, for example, and using things like DCS to facilitate fear reduction throughout exposure is a really good example.
Can you explain what DCS is?
DCS is a medication, a pharmacological agent, which has the effect of consolidating long-term learning. And several researchers have shown that when it's combined with exposure therapy, it enhances the learning from exposure therapy. And then there are other advances happening in the way in which we conceptualize fear reduction and what are the mechanisms that go into fear reduction and how that might then inform how to change the way we do exposure therapy. So that, in my mind, is one of the reasons why CBT is so effective, because it keeps up to date. And it's also a very focused, targeted, problem-solving oriented therapy. And I think that's another reason for its effectiveness.
Is it really considered a short-term form of therapy? And if that's so, what do therapists tell patients to expect in terms of length of treatment?
It certainly is considered a brief therapy relative to other types of therapies. Now, the research trials typically go from 12 to 16 weeks of therapy, which, you know, is 3 to 4 months. What happens in clinical practice is probably a lot different. In my own clinical practice, when I talk with patients and clients, I usually indicate that this will be a 3 to 4 month treatment. But I've also learned from my own research, actually, that booster sessions following the completion of that initial treatment phase are actually highly effective in maintaining long-term benefits. And so I tend to structure my therapies so that it might be once a week for 12 to 16 weeks and then gradually wean it out, but keep in touch over the next 6 to 12 months, simply, again, because of the research showing that that really has a positive effect.
What steps do you take when the therapy, the CBT, doesn't work as you expect it to with the patient?
Yes. When it doesn't work, there are a number of different ways to go. One is to go back to the functional analysis. And what I mean by that is go back to the model that I, as a therapist, and the patient client have developed together to understand why is this behavior happening in the way it's happening. What are the things we need to target? How do we need to change the thinking or the behaving or the responding? And revisit that, because we may have been off target. That would be one step. Another thing that I would look at is what I call treatment credibility. So the client's belief that this will work, which in turn, I think, is highly dependent on their understanding of the rationale. And so I would want to go back and reestablish the meaning of the treatment, the purpose of the treatment, why we're doing, or why I'm suggesting that we do the things the way that we do. I would look at motivational issues. Is there something that's hindering motivation to engage in the treatment? And maybe related to that, I would look at personal resources. So is the individual in such a difficult plight and without any kind of support in their environment that to engage in CBT, which takes effort, takes work, may be just a little overwhelming, and that in that case I would try to find ways of structuring things differently or getting the help of significant others or other support mechanisms.
So is this what you term treatment resistance in a patient who's having difficulty?
Yeah, treatment resistance I would operationalize as the person who is not completing homework assignments. That's a good index of treatment resistance. The person who's not engaging in a collaborative relationship about the cognitive restructuring, so that there's an unwillingness to sort of consider different ways of thinking, and of course the person who doesn't show up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So motivation and lack of understanding fully are some reasons that patients resist treatment.
They are some reasons. I also think that treatment resistance, when it's defined like that, can derive from extremely high fear and anxiety. So the person who is very, very anxious may be too afraid to proceed with cognitive behavioral therapy. And that's, you know, the task of the therapy is to try to help that person engage.
That was my next question. What can a therapist do to address that person?
Right. Well, again, I think if we're talking treatment resistance from all these different angles, the therapist is going to do different things based on where is the resistance coming from. So if it's a lack of credibility, then I think the therapist's job in that situation is to go back and educate the patient or client about the purpose of the treatment and what it's intended to do. Maybe provide other examples of other people who've gone through treatments. Maybe this is where even media can be helpful in just educating about how other people have succeeded in treatment using CBT. There is another aspect to the motivation which sometimes pops up, and that is that maybe an individual's coming in for CBT for anxiety, but in their home environment, they're being reinforced, whether it's purposefully or not, for being anxious. And so sometimes it helps to look at the entire contextual circumstances to try to establish, you know, maybe it would be helpful to bring family members into treatment if there are maladaptive reinforcement patterns going on.
Are some anxiety disorders more prone to resistance than others?
That's a good question. I don't really think so. I'm trying to think right now just in terms of attrition rates when we do our treatment studies. And I think the attrition rate may, you know, the people who drop out, may be more dependent on difficulty getting into treatment. So, for example, in individuals with panic disorder and agoraphobia, it seems to be the case that the more severe the agoraphobia, the higher the dropout rate. So I don't know if it's by type of disorder so much as the individual's own, what they're dealing with. And that reminds me, I'll just come back to, if it is the case that treatment resistance is coming from the person being too afraid, I would try to grade the treatment or do things a little bit more slowly and particularly engage the client to design what they can do rather than the therapist giving the client assignments.
So that's another way that the patient gets a little bit of control over the recovery.
Right, exactly.
What is your personal wish list for research areas that you'd like to see undertaken in terms of this topic?
Well, I think we need to do a lot more work on long-term follow-up effects. We've done a pretty good job of demonstrating that cognitive behavioral therapy can work in the short term. Not a lot of studies have evaluated patterns of relapse, not in anxiety anyway. And those that have suggest that there is a bit of relapse, and so we need to develop better ways of offsetting that relapse, hence my discussion of the booster sessions. I think we need to do a lot more on the mechanisms because if we know more about the mechanisms of CBT, we can optimize the CBT much better. And mechanistic research is hard to do, especially if you do it the right way, but I think it's needed.
Can you talk about what that is exactly?
So when we talk about mechanisms, we're talking about what are the factors that seem to be causing therapeutic change. So, for example, within cognitive theory, the assumption is that change in belief systems, change in the way that the individual thinks, is the basic mechanism by which people get better. Now, to really assess that, you have to assess the belief system at the beginning of treatment, and then at some later point, but before symptoms have changed, so that you can test whether the change in the beliefs from the beginning of treatment to the somewhere middle of treatment, whether that change in beliefs in turn predicts change in symptoms. So we're a little bit stuck because we don't know where to do the measurement. And furthermore, it's very hard to do the measurement. I don't know if relying on a self-report questionnaire about how a person thinks is really adequate to really get at this notion of beliefs. But nonetheless, I think that's a very important area of research because it'll help us to optimize treatment and maybe also help us to know which individuals are going to do best with the treatment. In terms of research areas, I think a lot more work on at-risk samples within the population. Without stigmatizing individuals, but individuals who are showing the risk factors and providing preventative intervention is very important, because what we do know is that anxiety, once it's fully manifested, tends to become quite chronic unless treated, and that the treatments seem to be much more effective at a young age than at an older age, and that these preventative models, at least in some of the studies that have been done, are effective. So I think that would be another area. I have more. I think much more work on the medication CBT combination needs to be done, particularly how to combine them in such a way that the client doesn't lose out from the combination. What I mean by that is if medications are added to CBT, sometimes the result of that can be that the client doesn't engage in as much homework because the medication's working. Now, that makes reasonable sense. But what we also know is that engagement in homework throughout CBT is a good predictor of long-term outcome. And so we have to work at, you know, helping people to take medication but without detracting from their involvement in CBT. Similarly, there's some work on the way in which people attribute treatment gains. And if the attribution is to the CBT and not the medication, then that's one effect. If the attribution is to the medication and not the CBT, that seems to predict relapse once the medications are withdrawn. So more work on how to prevent medication from losing out in that case. So these are some of the ideas for medication combinations.
Very good. Very illuminating. Thank you, Dr. Krask. This is Jean Kaplan-Tycho for ADAA.